The whole point of this exercise is to identify what's your unique differentiators, which is which performance benefit are you going to be the best on, right? So here the competition is medium on this, and we're going to be the best, and we have a delighter. Like, you don't compete on must-haves. So that's how I like to think about it. And then to be clear, you would want this benefit that you're the best on. That should have been one of those benefits that was in the upper left quadrant. That's where it gets really complicated. Is can we come up with something where we can beat the competition and it's an opportunity in the marketplace, right? Yeah. And if you can, then you're like golden. I mean, if you can find a combination of a segment and a need that you can be higher than outperform your competition and it's in the upper left quadrant, then now you are so set up to create more value, you know, than the competition. Yeah. You've done the strategic work to do that, right? To make sure you're set up for success.
Welcome to a new episode of Product Directions Podcast, 100 Product Strategies. We are your insider access to top product leaders shaping the strategy of the most diverse industries today. I'm your host, Nacho Vassino, and I'll be digging into the real-life situations, problems, and frameworks used for strategy with product people all around the world in all kinds of products and markets. While there is no recipe for success, listening to others' experiences may give you the edge you need to solve your next strategic challenge.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode. Today, I'm really excited because I'm with none other than Dan Olsen. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Nacho. It's great to be here.
I assume most people listening to this will already know who you are, but maybe for those who don't, can you give us a brief intro?
Sure, Nacho. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So my name is Dan Olsen. I've been working in the field of product management for quite a while now, before it was as popular as it is today. Started my product management career at Intuit. I moved out here to Silicon Valley, where I've been living ever since, to go to business school, and Intuit basically was told to me to be a good place to learn product management. So I was there for a while. Then I was a product leader at several startups. And then I got into being a product management consultant, interim VP of product for startups. I've been speaking for a while. I wrote a book called The Lean Product Playbook. And I'm also the founder of a community here that we run actually here in Silicon Valley, as well as globally, called Lean Product Meetup, where we share, you know, bring in top speakers and share advice. So that's pretty much what keeps me busy. I teach a lot of private training workshops in addition. So
that's awesome. And actually, yeah. Why I'm so excited to talk with you about strategy is because I read your book, I would say, early in my career, probably was 2015, 16. Yeah. It was not that early in my career, but anyway. And I realized that's one of the moments when the topic of the problem space really clicked for me. With your examples, mm-hmm. with the space pen and TurboTax. So that's exactly what I want to talk with you about, how the connection between problem space and strategy, because I feel that this is something that is sometimes either misunderstood or not done properly, and I want to hear your tips. So maybe a good way to start is maybe asking you a bit of a conceptual thinking on problem space, well, how you define it, and maybe give some words about it.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting because I've been talking about problem space publicly since 2006, and I'm excited that you see it come up in blogs and discussions a lot more these days than it used to. And one of the ways I like to tie it back is, you know, we all know that like 80% of new products fail, or there's all these statistics about 80% of startups fail, or new products fail, or fail to meet their objectives. You know, sometimes it's 90% depending on the survey. And I think one of the core reasons, what I've realized, what I've started to say, is one of the core reasons why is they were not solving a relevant, meaningful customer problem, right? And what happens, a lot of times people fall in love with some new technology or solution. Hey, let's build this thing, you know, and I think it'll be cool. And so the problem space versus solution space is just this framework that's like splits, tries to separate these two things. They're obviously related to each other, but it's more of a mindset thing where a customer problem is basically, you know, what are you trying to do to create value for the customer? And it's really independent of any solution. And once you get to that level of thinking about it, you realize, like, let's say I want to make it easier to share photos with my friends. That statement, make it easier to share photos with my friends, that's a problem-based statement. I didn't say how I'm going to do it. You may have envisioned an app that's going to do that or a website that's going to do that, but I didn't say that yet, right? So that's the idea, is can we separate the solution from the problem? and then, you know, and then later, you know, come up with solution ideas. Because what happens is far too often teams rush into solution space. Let's build this feature. Let's add this widget. Let's do this thing, right? And it's usually oftentimes it's the technology du jour. Blockchain, let's go do blockchain. Everybody, what's your blockchain strategy? Right? You think blockchain is not a problem. It's a solution. It's a technology, right? There's a little bit of that going on with Gen AI now. Now, the good news is these tools seem to provide value. So it's not, you know, but again, a lot of people, we have this wave, and I think a lot of percentage of these startups are going to fail because they're just like, Gen AI. It's like, that's a solution, not a problem, right? So that, and I understand why. I'm not trying to be overly critical. I mean, we live in the solution space, right? Our default mode of thinking is solution space. So I understand why everybody does that. Developers have to ship code in the solution space. Designers have to create pixel designs in the solution space. So, you know, so it's like, okay, who on the team should be thinking about the problem space? That's where it falls on product management. That's your main value add. Yeah, you might be QAing the product, you know. Yeah, you may be reviewing the designs. You're going to, you know, comment on what the developers and designers are doing. But your main value add is defining who's our customer and what problems can we solve for them. That's basically it. So that's it. Again, our customer, a problem is a customer problem, need, or benefit that you're trying to address. The other way I like to explain it is most people are familiar with the template for an agile user story. As a blank type of customer, I want to be able to blank so I can blank. That last part, so I can, that is the essence of problem space. Why would a customer care about this? How is it going to create value for them? So, and then in contrast, a solution space is a specific product or design intended to address that problem. That's the idea. We wanted to separate the two. The message is not, hey, don't ever think about solution space. It's just what happens is far too often seem to go rushing into solution space, spend enough time thinking about the problems before you. And then, you know, so once you said, hey, we want to make it easier to share portfolios with your friends, the very next thing you can do is, great, let's brainstorm all the ways we can think of to do that. Those would be solutions tied to that problem.
Yeah. I think that's great. And it's what I have seen is that, well, for example, the hypes that you mentioned are great. At the end of the day, new technologies can enable the solution of different problems. So it's a good place to start, but it would still need to go back and think about the problem. And to be honest, the real problem I was thinking about is that some of these examples, like photo sharing, are common in the startup space, in which kind of probably we are trying to solve one problem and it's kind of very clear and we are very focused. But once we, and usually product leaders come into play when the company is a bit larger, either a scale up or already an enterprise or kind of leading a business unit. So what I have found is that the opportunities to solve different problems are much wider. So you can have a much more complex problem space because you have solved the, let's say, photo sharing problem.
Sure.
And now you need to expand and you need to think about different things. So maybe what's your experience or some tips on how to start, I'm saying mapping, but kind of figuring out this problem space?
Yeah, I think that's good. So I think, you know, one way to think about it is, you know, when we talk about people and skills development, we talk about like a T-shaped person who's deep in one area, right? Versus wide, what we can think about is that main problem that you're trying to, the first main problem you're trying to solve is like that T. And the first thing I would say is, the other analogy I use is peeling an onion, because you know, your first idea is the outer layer of the onion. And as you really do good discovery and really get in there, it's really hard to get too detailed in that, in any given problem, right? You may say at the high level, I want to make it easier to share photos with your friends. But then when you get into it, it'd be like, okay, how do we make it easier to, you know, pick the right photos, to pick the friends, to pick the method of sharing, right? So one thing I want to say is it's really hard to get too detailed even on one problem. So let's assume you've done that. I think your question is, okay, we've nailed that one problem pretty good. We've gone deep in that T, the staff, the part of the T. Now, how do we expand sideways? How do we expand to other adjacent problem cases around, right? So that's where, again, I use two different terms. One is exploring the problem space. So this is fun. This is a fun brainstorming exercise that you can do with your team where you just say, okay, we want to make photo sharing easy for people. What are all the ideas? What are all the different, you know, benefits we can think of, like detailed benefits of brainstorm that, right? And then you kind of, so that's, you just, it's messy. You just brainstorm all the different things you could do, right? And like, as you mentioned in the book for TurboTax, I do this, right? You might think that, oh, TurboTax just solves a couple of basic needs. But as you brainstorm, you realize they can solve a lot of detailed needs, right? And then the next step is I like to then you say, okay, let's try to make sense of this. And that's what I call defining your problem space, where you go through, you eliminate duplicates, right? Sometimes people use the same words for different things. Sometimes people brainstorm ideas at different levels of specificity. Some people are very specific in detail. Some people are very high level. So you try to make sense of that. And then you organize them by what I call a benefit ladder, which is basically like, okay, we brainstormed 10 different detailed problems we could solve, but they all have to do with saving people time on their taxes. So we're going to put them all into the save time bucket. You know, they are distinct benefits, right? And then we're going to have save money as a second one. So what happens in the long run, back to what you're saying, is say you're successful with your first product and it's done a good job of solving that main problem. Now you need to decide what are the adjacent problems that we could solve for people. There's two ways to go. One is you could say, let's try to solve adjacent problems for the same audience. Or you could say, let's try to expand our audience. And the way we need to solve this problem for that adjacent audience is slightly different because they do have a couple of unique needs, right? So those are kind of the two ways typically to expand over time that you can do.
So essentially, I think for that latter one, I think in the typical case in B2B space, hey, maybe we are, you know, mid-sized companies and we go to enterprise or the other way around, these typical challenges.
Or verticals, right? Verticals. Health tech. Yeah. And, you know, which adjacent segment has the closest needs so that with the least amount of incremental work, we can also penetrate that segment. Is it legal? Is it finance? You know, like that's – and that's where I'll just make a brief mention. I'm a big fan of Jeffrey Moore's work. So Jeffrey Moore wrote Crossing the Chasm. I've hosted him at Lean Product Meetup several times. His second book is actually Inside the Tornado. And if you haven't read any of Jeffrey Moore's books, especially for your B2B enterprise space, you know, they're older books. So some people don't know about them. It's great. I would recommend reading Inside the Tornado. In there, he has a framework of he calls it the bowling alley. And he's got the 10 bowling pins. And the idea is the head pin, the first pin in front, that's the first vertical use case that you hit, that you solve. And the question is, which way do you go? Do you use that pin to knock down the next pin? Do you go deeper in that vertical or do you take that problem and go to the adjacent vertical? So it's a nice framework.
Interesting. I haven't read that second one. Interesting. Good to know. I will link it in the notes.
Yeah, why I like it, Nacho, is because he summarizes all of Crossing the Chasm and then he builds on it. So I would read inside.
You can skip the first one, then.
No, honestly, you don't have to. Yeah, he summarizes it. I do think if you that's why I say if you haven't read any Jeffrey Moore books, jump in with Inside the Tornado for sure.
Perfect, lovely. That's interesting because now at the point we have been brainstorming with the team. We have some buckets, but now comes the difficult part. You simplify the act of selecting which niche is the one which may be bigger and with less incremental effort. But that can be quite hard and also can be quite opinionated and stakeholders jumping at your neck and things like that. So what are maybe some tips to start to select or organize how we think about these spaces?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, Acha, because what we've done so far is we've diverged. We've kind of said, what are all the problems we could solve, right? Mm-hmm. Suspending kind of judgment. We didn't say, how long is this going to take to build or code yet? Is this even feasible, technically feasible, economically feasible? We've done divergent thinking, right? So if you know, everyone knows the diamond. We've done the divergent part, and now is a good time to say, great. Why don't we try to evaluate these ideas? And the way I like to phrase it is to identify which of them represent the biggest opportunities. And this is the thing is there's a lot of frameworks out there that, saying, hey, let's start with the customer, be customer centric. Let's start with problems. There's a lot of people saying that out there, right? But there aren't that many frameworks that then give you a way to prioritize these opportunities, basically, right? Yeah. And so that's one of the things in my book that's unique is I have a framework that does it. The other person that does is Tony Olwick, who's a jobs to be done advocate. He's got a framework too, but because it can be messy, like you said, it can be very subjective when you're debating, okay, there's these six problems we could solve. Which one should we is the biggest opportunity? Well, this stakeholder thinks it's this one. This stakeholder thinks this one. They've got opinions. We don't have a lot of data and people can, and this is where human language kind of can get in the way too, of like people arguing this is a must have and this is high priority. This is a P1. We got to do this. Is it a nice to have? Is it a vitamin? Is it a flower? You know, you get all kinds of this stuff going on, right? And so for me, you know, early in my career, when I was wrestling with this, trying to figure out the best way to come up with like kind of a somewhat rigorous analytical framework to do this is importance versus satisfaction, right? So basically the importance, you know, we just got done talking about the problem space. This is, okay, we have six problems we could solve. How important is each one of them to our target customer? So we can score them low. And I put it low to high. You don't need to do numbers or quant. You can just use low to high. It usually works. But you're basically scoring the relative importance. And the key thing here, Nacho, is it's importance to the target customer. If you change, if you talk to one set of customers, they're going to give you one set of importance scores. If you talk to a different customer type, they're going to give you a different importance score. So this is a function of the customer, right? And then the satisfaction is, okay, however they're getting that need met today, like say it's taxes, say they're doing it themselves or they're using an accountant, how satisfied are they with how they're getting it met today? That's basically the idea.
Yeah.
Right. And then you end up, you know, you can end up doing high, medium, low like this, and you can put sticky notes, you don't need to get quantitative. You can just have sticky notes where you put each problem and you post it up there. Right.
Yeah.
And then you end up basically, I'll jump to the punchline slide where at the end of the day, you know, these two bottom left, the bottom quadrants are not worth going after because it's a low importance need. And nobody does this on purpose. Nobody says, let's do it. But because they don't have data or using their gut or they're going off or maybe they think they're the target customer, they end up doing those ideas. In the upper right quadrant, you have high importance of user need, but you also have high satisfaction. So yes, it's an important need, but customers have already found something they're happy with. That's a competitive market. And that's where you hear people say you need to be 10x better. This is where you need to be 10x better.
Yeah.
And then the last quadrant is this one where it's high importance of user need. So people are telling you it's an important need and they're telling you they have low satisfaction. They haven't yet found a high satisfaction solution. This is where opportunities lie. So, you know, to sum everything up these days, like we talk about 80% of new products fail. The top two reasons they fail are one, they did not like validate the problem. They didn't start with a problem and validate that it was real, right? They just jumped in, fell in love with the technology and built something. The second thing is if they identified the problem, they didn't confirm that it's in this upper left quadrant. That's the two. If you do those two things, start with the problem and do this simple analysis and make sure the problem you're solving is up here, you're going to mitigate most of that 80% of the risk because now it's just a matter of execution, right? And so that's how I like to do it. So this is how I like to converge. You literally plot these.
I have two questions to that. Trying to put you in a tough spot, but the first one is how opinionated this scoring can be. I'm not scoring, but kind of you know, going back to saying stakeholders may have different opinions or interpretations of the data.
The thing is, most of the discussions with – so back to the initial discussion, most of the discussion with stakeholders tend to be in the solution space. We need this feature. This feature is the highest priority feature. This solution is – So part of its little Jedi mind trick is we're shifting the conversation to talking about the problems first.
Yeah.
Because part of why people disagree on the prioritization of solutions is when you jump to solution space, you're not even clear on what problem you're solving, right? So there was a subtle thing there of like – we're shifting the conversation. Now, when I've done this, there is opinion still, right? So I do this in my workshops, I have people put up their ideas. And this is where, you know, there's two ways to do this, several ways to do it. But one is without talking to any customers, let's just get the stakeholders in a room and have them say where they think they go, right?
Yeah.
And you usually get some consensus. I know a stakeholder can have a pet idea or something. That's cool. But then you have a discussion about it and they realize, okay, they're the only one in the room that feels that way. Like everyone else is putting the importance low and they're putting the importance high. At least they can get some self-awareness about that, right?
Yeah.
And you can decide, okay, we're going to average the scores or whatever, right? So that's one thing. The next thing, the very next thing is always, we still haven't talked to any customers. We haven't validated this with any customers. Right?
Yeah.
It's our hypothesis that this is in this quadrant, this needs are in these quadrants, right? So the very next thing we would do is we would do customer discovery research and go out and talk to customers and have, you know, ask them the importance and satisfaction, right?
Yeah.
And see if it jives with what we did. So that's where you can get real world data instead of just opinions from inside the building to help inform this, right?
Yeah. The second question I think I was already solved great part of it. But the second question is about these different customer segments. So do you usually suggest selecting first the customer segment? Because at the end of the day, you may find opportunities in different segments or different sites.
You have to. In fact, I do this in my workshop for the same set of six problems. We take one customer segment and we run the importance and satisfaction. And when we run that one, almost 99% of the time, no post-it notes, no problems or needs end up in the upper left quadrant. So then I take a step back and I go, okay, class, what does that mean? And then they finally realize, well, we probably shouldn't go after that segment because we don't have a big opportunity for them. So I'm like, cool, let's go rerun the analysis for this other segment. And when we rerun it for the other segment, you usually end up with one benefit that's red hot in that red area and two that are in the orange. And you still end up with three that are in the blue that you don't want to do, but it's very different. So then I flip between the two graphs and I'm like, okay, so it's exactly that, right? So that's kind of, it's like this multidimensional puzzle you're trying to solve. And that's it. It's like, what's the combination of, you know, customer and problem? Because everything's a function of the customer. Is the product market fit pyramid is basically the main framework for my book and my work, which is everything starts with the customer. So we've been talking about needs, which is here. But the needs, like if you're a math geek, like it's a function of the customer. So if you're talking about this customer, you're going to get one set of importance and satisfaction values. If you say, let's talk about this other customer, you're going to get a different set of importance and satisfaction values, right? And then the other thing I like to point out is when you jump straight to a feature idea, you're jumping straight to this point. You've skipped all steps 1, 2, and 3. When you jump to solution space, you're jumping to step 4. So it's like ready, fire, aim. So it's like no wonder – you know, the odds are so low because we're just, you know, it's kind of like throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks at that point. It's just luck.
Yeah. I understand. What's interesting is that at the end of the day, selecting the, so let me put it another way. There is a combination of customer segment and kind of importance of the need to make the selection. It's not independent.
Yep. That's right.
Okay, I love that.
And it's funny because the beauty of it, Nacho, is I know that when you're debating these inside of the company, it can be very noisy, lots of opinions, lack of alignment, no agreement. The cool thing is when I run this workshop exercise with that simple framework, and we don't talk to any customers, but people on the team just use their intuition, they all come to the conclusion, ooh, we should not do target segment 1, does not make sense because we don't have any high opportunity needs. Like it's just everybody, you know. So part of it is like, you know, a lot of product management, product development, it's like it's foggy. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of fog. And so, you know, having a simple one-page powerful framework can help people kind of cut through the fog and just see, okay, yeah, for this target segment, it doesn't make sense. But for this other one, it does. You know, you don't have to be the one. It's not like you, the PM, have to convince them. You show them on the framework and they all kind of go, okay, yeah. So, but your point is right. You know, basically, when you're trying to go 0 to 1, you basically, what's the combination of the target segment and the problem or problems we can solve for them that's in the upper left quadrant? And you're kind of playing with both of those. And that's what happens all the time, right? The number of companies that pivot is huge. Many successful companies that pivot because they start out with one hypothesis. Hey, we're going to solve this problem for this customer. And they go out there and they build it, they launch it, and they realize, oh, they didn't really like that, you know. But this adjacent segment is using it. Let's go talk to them, and then they pivot their product. You know what I mean? So one of the examples I talk about in the workshop is Instagram. So Instagram is a photo sharing app. It didn't start out that way. They actually started out with a broader mobile, like a social networking app, and they weren't getting the traction. You know, I actually just listened to a book called No Filter that talks about their history. And I knew about their history before, but I just kind of learned more about it from the book. But basically, they realized we're not getting the track. It was more like a Foursquare. It was more like a check-in kind of app and things like that. And they were honest. They were great. They were honest with themselves. They were focused on the problem space. And they said, you know, we're not getting the traction we want. What can we do? And they said, what is it that people value the most out of this app? And they made a list of the three things. And the biggest thing was the photo sharing. So they said, what if we just pivoted and we started from scratch with a photo sharing app? And then they said, great, but there are already some photo sharing apps. So how else can ours be better or different? Which we'll get to in the strategy section later maybe. But that was – so they were very deliberate in that exercise. So
Yeah. Actually, it's a side note, but actually in this direction, you mentioned if we don't – I mean, we can agree seeing all these posts on the wall, but – it's good to have some validation. So we do some customer survey. how do you recommend or doing enough discovery to understand if the problem is correct and select the strategy before jumping to actual solution discovery?
Yeah. I mean, one thing is, so I like to do, you know, at this point, you're probably going to be doing qualitative interviews, right? So like step one is let's get everybody in the room and let's try to place the post-it notes. And it can be very powerful to do that. The next thing is great. Let's actually go talk to those customers and see if they agree with where we've placed them, right? And so one thing is just the scale. This is how I like to just, even if I'm doing qualitative, I like to use a scale. Because again, if you're not, if I just said, hey, Nacho, how important is that to you? You might go, oh, that's kind of important. I don't have any sense of like on a scale of 1 to 10 or 1 to 5, right? So I like to, even when I'm talking with people qualitatively, I'll be like, hey, great. Can you, you know, where on the scale is, how important is it, right? And then saying, and for satisfaction, I use the scale. And people can be happy or they can be unhappy. And so even if I've done 10 people, I'll look at the average score and I'll look at the distribution. It's not statistically significant. But usually you can tell, you get directional evidence that says, yeah, everyone seems to agree this is high importance. Oh, yeah, everyone seems to agree this is low importance. And one thing actually I'll say is, if you get mixed results, this is a telltale sign. Remember, in the foundation of the pyramid is your customer. Say, and I usually give this example, like say you got to the prototype stage. You mocked up your idea, right? And you showed it to 10 customers. And 5 absolutely loved it. But 5 were kind of like, nah, it's not for me, right? Then that is a hint that you have not specified your target customer enough. Your mission now, there's some missing explanation. There's some missing reason. Why did these 5 like it and these 5 not? Because ostensibly they're all in the same segment, right? Oh, they were all in health tech. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. They were all, let's do that. They're all e-commerce. And we showed they're all e-commerce and they all have, you know, there's all mid-sized e-commerce companies. So why did 5 like it and 5 not? Well, you're missing some segmentation attribute, right? And it could be, the example I typically say is, well, maybe 5 of them had really simple inventory needs and your product met those simple needs, or they don't manage inventory, but the other 5 have really complex inventory needs and your product didn't meet it for them, right? That would be an explanation.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So if you're getting noisy results on even on small sample sizes of 10, right? You know, if you're like 8 out of 10 people like it, you're like, okay, cool, we're on to something here. But you know, if you get disagreement, then you might need to sharpen the pencil on your target customer. So that's how I like to do it. You know, you could try to do surveys at scale. There's a lot of pros and cons of surveys. I personally like to just validate it with qualitative research. You might need to do more than one round, you know, to kind of get to like, hey, we feel good about this is the segment. These are the problems, but it shouldn't be too hard to get there.
Actually, I mean, this is kind of the first step of your discovery. Once you are done with this part, you will continue validating the solution, so on. So it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually is a good connection to this connecting the problem space to strategy, which is probably the core to. We took a long time to get here, but that's the core we need to discuss.
Yes.
How are those two connected? I mean, again, going back to, we are done with the startup phase or kind of solving this problem. Now we are trying to select some bigger or problem to expand to. How we connect problem space with strategy?
Yeah. So the funny thing is, so you know, let's snap our fingers and say, okay, we've done the qualitative research to validate for this segment. If we solve these one or two problems, they're red hot or orange, we're good to go. The next thing we need to get clear on is how are we going to be better than the competition? Right? How are we going to deliver more value than the competition? Because it's one thing to address the needs. It's another to say we're going to be better than the, you know, how are we going to be better than the competition? I like to basically use the Kano model, which is must have performance and delighters. Once you do your needs are going to fall into one of these three categories, right? And most, I'll just jump to the point, you mainly compete on performance, right? Hey, we're 10% faster than the competition. We're 40% higher quality than competition, right? We're 10% cheaper than the competition. Any of those things where you're comparing yourself and saying you're X percent better, that's a performance benefit or feature. Okay. That's where most of the competition has. Must haves, you just have to have them. It's like if you're in health tech, you need to have HIPAA. If you're in financial services, you need to have encrypted transactions, right? So you don't compete on these. What happens is every once in a while, a stakeholder will try to say something, one of these is a must have, will try to, because, but it's not really a must have, right? And then the final one is a delighter, where if you don't have it, it doesn't cause a problem, but by having it, you can create a lot of things, right? And so the reason I bring that up is I like to just, for your product strategy, create a simple one-page table. I call it the product strategy grid. And you list for your category, one per row, must-have performance and delighters, right? Mm-hmm. And then this is where you explicitly bring in the competition. This is where we get really clear and we say, great, who are our competitors? And then we have a column for our product. And then the next thing we do is we score the competitors, right, on how good a job. And honestly, high, medium, low usually works fine. You don't need to get too more complicated than that. And this is where we say, okay, what row do we plan to win on? Well, what are we going to be the best on, right? And this is where, you know, human nature is to try to say high. And I run this exercise all the time in my workshops. People pick like high. We're going to be high on all the things. But that's not feasible, right? We don't have the team. We don't have the resources. It'd be great. And that's why my favorite, you know, definition of strategy, it's related to the Steve Jobs quote where he talks about people think focus means saying yes to the thing you've got to focus on. That's not what it means. It means saying no to the 100 good ideas. Innovation is saying no to 1,000 things. I like to just paraphrase it. Strategy means saying no, right? If you are not saying no, and I'm especially thinking of our friends in B2B where the sales team, when the sales team calls on a new customer and they say, are you going to have feature X? What do they say? Oh, yeah, just sign the contract. We'll build it, right? They say yes to everything because they have an incentive to do that, right? So you need to say no. And so you got to pick your battles, right? And you basically, you know, what you want to do, the whole point of this exercise is to identify what's your unique differentiators, which is which performance benefit are you going to be the best on, right? So here the competition is medium on this and we're going to be the best and we have a delighter. Like you don't compete on must-haves. So that's how I like to think about it. And then to be clear, you would want this benefit that you're the best on. That should have been one of those benefits that was in the upper left quadrant. That's where it gets really complicated. Is can we come up with something where we can beat the competition and it's an opportunity in the marketplace, right?
Yeah.
And if you can, then you're like golden. I mean, if you can find a combination of a segment and a need that you can be higher than your outperform your competition and it's in the upper left quadrant, then now you are so set up to create more value, you know, than the competition. Yeah. You've done the strategic work to do that, right? To make sure you're set up for success.
An interesting question around that is, can you actually have a delighter that appears in the upper left quadrant of the matrix? Because what I'm thinking about is this delighter, if you don't have it, it's not a problem, probably is not a high importance under some need.
Yeah, well, I would argue, so the thing I would say, if we go back to the importance of satisfaction, I think delighters can add satisfaction, so they can move things to the right, for a given need, right? So... I love your question. The importance just depends what problem did that delighter solve, address. If it solves a high importance problem, then it's delivering a high importance problem, right?
Yeah. But,
and usually, you know, that usually it would be if it's going to create a lot of value. Like, so just to stick with Instagram, for example, what made Instagram so good? And you know, when they came into the mobile photo sharing market, they quickly became number one. They never looked back. And when I asked people, what's the number one, when you think about what they did to be so popular, what was it? Usually the first answer I get is filters. Oh, they had those amazing filters for your photos. The next thing I like to say to people is, great, is filters a solution or a problem? It's a solution, which is fine. We use a Y hack when we have, I call it solution pollution. When you have solution pollution, it's perfectly fine. You do a Y hack and you say, okay, why? Here's solution pollution. Why were filters valuable to you as an early Instagram user? And people say things like makes my photos look better, makes my photos look more creative, more professional, stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
But then I say, great, when filters first came out on Instagram, were they a must-have or a performance or a delighter? They were a delighter because nobody else had them, right? So delighters can't, I mean, I think what I would say to agree with you is having only a delighter is not usually enough. You have to outperform on something, right? It's nice to have a delighter. But it's more like a bonus. You got to have some raw outperform. You got to be faster, cheaper, or something. You got to, you know, something. And then that's like the cherry on top. And then what I like to say is when I've analyzed a lot of products through this lens is time and again, when you see some product that came out and was just hugely successful, Instagram, Uber, Airbnb, it's a combination of a clear performance that they had plus like a delighter. And it's like this, you know, and that's a very strong combination. So
Good. One thing that you showed, and I think it's interesting also to consider, is that I would phrase this as a question. When you are not being kind of equal in performance with your competitors, you decide to be lower performance. Is this because
the type of niche you are
selecting? Is type of niche or type of kind of these customers will care more about this type of performance need, sort of?
That's exactly right, because everything's a function of the customer, right? And that's the thing. And that's if you read books like Innovator's Dilemma and things like that, right? How does David beat Goliath? How does the new startup beat that big company? It's almost always they launch a product that has like a subset of the features, right? And the big company looks at it and goes, look at that piece of junk. That's a toy. We've got all these features, right? And then, but the thing is, they identified a niche, a segment that really values it, and they found one thing that's better. Sometimes it's lower price, something, right? Something that's better, right? One example that comes to mind from the United States is an airlines, Southwest Airlines, right? Back in the day, there were all these normal airlines that had their normal operating model, and Southwest said, we're gonna have cheaper flights, like no frills, and we're gonna like have shorter flights and more airports. And it worked. And so people, if you wanted to save money, you would use Southwest, right? And they would save you a lot of money. Now, not everybody, obviously most people in general, if you said you want to save money, they will. But some people like the other stuff. But anyway, that's an example where that's how you get disrupted. So yes, it is a function of that. And that's where it's super easy, again, to make fun of our friends in sales to say, hey, our product, that's where you get into the feature checklist wars. Are those happening? Those are happening in the solution space. They have this feature, so we have to have it too. You know, that it's like copying your homework, copying the test answers from the guy next to you. How do you know that they know what they're doing? How do you know that they did it right, right? I guarantee we just got done saying 80% of new products fail. So they probably didn't clarify their target market. They probably didn't define the problem space. They probably didn't run importance and satisfaction. They probably didn't do the value property. That's why it's an alternative way of thinking. It's like, no, we have done our research and we know that for this segment, these needs don't matter, but this need is really important and we're going to focus on that. And that's why we think we can go out with a product that only has this feature set, and we can say no to that thing that everybody else is just including, right? One of the things from Tony Olbick's framework is he talks about overserved needs. Like, you know, if you're delivering something that nobody cares about, then you're wasting resources, you know, on delivering it. We all know that when we launch features, sometimes not everybody uses all the features. And so if you look at the feature usage, you might find that, hey, this one feature that we launched 2 years ago, less than 5% of users are using it, but we keep maintaining it. We'll kill it, right? That is, you know, like kill it. And so that's an example of overserved or not meeting a need. Yeah. So yes, you're totally right. You have to pick your battles, and that's how startups and smaller companies with less resources can beat bigger companies. Yeah. You know, the perfect example, Intuit, where I started, we competed against Microsoft, right? Microsoft was probably 100 times or more bigger than we were, and we were one of the few companies to succeed, and it was because we were way more customer-centric. We were close to our customers. We knew what they needed. We knew what they didn't need, you know. And so that's very empowering and can help you make smart resource trade-offs the more you know about the problems you're solving for your customers.
Yeah. I think it's interesting sideways to one of my last questions, which goes back to alignment, right? Because I'm going back and forth between this. It's opinionated, but we can get consensus. But every now and then, kind of at this specific level of strategy, when you are saying, hey, we will focus on this problem for this customer because we are expecting to have this kind of higher performance, can get into a very tricky space in terms of everyone having an opinion. The question goes around the lines of, when this debate on priorities plays out and you actually don't have much data to back it up because you still need to do more discovery, how do you select this strategy level or how create alignment or buy-in?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the point is, again, I'll use this metaphor. There's a lot of fog and uncertainty, right, when it comes to making product decisions. Yeah. And, you know, the job of good product managers is to try to cut through that fog as much as we can. And that's why for me, you'll notice that what I share with you are a few simple one-page frameworks to help get people on. They're decision-making tools so that, you know, you could use it as an individual PM to be like, let me get my thoughts straight and clear. What do I think the biggest opportunity need is, what do I think our product strategy should be? But then you can use them in a group setting to get alignment, right? So if we go back to like the value prop grid, which is where it all comes together, and to back to tie our discussion together, this is the interface between problem and solution. Because the very next thing we need to do is we need to say, okay, if we're going to be the best performance benefit three, whatever that is, how are we going to back that up with features? And what features are we going to deliver and build that are going to make us better, that are going to deliver higher performance, right? So this is the boundary. But basically, you throw this up, and, you know, this is – I've kept this generic, but, you know, this is where you can be like, it's a simple single-page decision-making tool. If you don't agree with what I'm proposing, you know, what do you want to do? Do you think we got the competitive analysis wrong? Like, so you can just go through and say, did we score the competitors wrong? And you can have a discussion about – okay, no, they're high here. That's one. It's like, hey, did we get, you know, so hopefully we can align on the competitive analysis. That's step one. And then step two is, okay, what strategy do you propose, right? And if they say, well, I want to be the best, I think we should be the best performance benefit too, then if I was the PM, I'd be like, great, sounds good. Competitor B is high. What is our plan for being higher than them? You know, what is our plan, right? Yeah. And that's how you back it up, right? The beauty of this exercise is, and when I run it is, I just expect teams to pick a row where nobody else is high. That's a no-brainer, right? If nobody else is high there, then you could be the best there, right? That's like the kind of like basic 101 strategy is nobody else is high. The other way to go is, well, somebody's high, but we're going to be higher, or we're going to do some kind of price performance thing, right? So anyway, it helps. Yeah. It helps. Yeah. Also, part of cutting through the fog is – instead of there being like a plethora of options and we don't know what's up, is now you've got a discrete number of, you know, okay, we've got three benefits we can be, you know, you can't, it's got to be one of these three, right? So it's like it narrows down the options from like potentially infinite to, okay, you know, and you could say, what would it look like if we wanted to be the best at performance benefit one? What would it look like? You know, you could talk about each example and talk about the pros and cons and see if you can get people aligned on that.
Actually, I think what I love about that is that at the end of the day, you are enabling a better conversation. Because at the end of the day, if we are all throwing opinions without no visuals or whatever, this one is kind of a very concrete way to go step by step. Hey, look at the competitors, look at the benefits, look at the customer segment. So it's very clear to drive the discussion. Because at the end of the day, I mean, if you are either a product leader or a product manager, probably you don't have all the decision power in the world. So if you are making this strategy to make a bet, it's good that maybe it's not my bet, it's a bet that the CEO choose, but at least we understand why we're doing it and we have a concrete framework to explain it. So it's quite good.
Yeah, what I would say is you're right. We are not always empowered. You know, product management is empowered to different degrees, but I would say it's our job to provide the recommendation and rationale, right? Yep. And they may change. They may say, no, we think it should be this or that. I would just be really clear. I don't think it's enough for PM just to show up with an empty grid and go, okay, what do you want to do? Right. Like we should be like, here's our view of the competitive analysis. Here's what we think. If you happy to discuss any disagreements or differences of opinion, let's talk about it. And I would still guide them through step by step. But my point is I would have an opinion or recommendation. To your point, I can't unilaterally enact that recommendation. You need to get buy-in from stakeholders. But part of it too is how good is your recommendation? How good is your rationale? Because a lot of times PMs go into those meetings with a recommendation, but then they get all these questions asked. And next thing you know, people are like, I don't know about that. And it's like, if people say it's like, you know, in the absence of data, we're going to go with opinions. We're going to go with my opinion, right? I mean, so that's what people do, right?
Even in that scenario, I mean, at the end of the day, even as a PM with all your research, you are making a bet. I mean, you can have
true
insights to make a bet, but you're making a bet.
Yes.
So that's right. I tend to say that these are not kind of, you don't need to think about losing a battle. It's more like, hey, I expose my opinions, my evidence-backed opinions, but they may have others. And at the end of the day, if by using these frameworks, what you can do is to extract the rationale and then go back to your discovery board and put the rationale to the test. So even either way, you win.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, these are still hypotheses, right? I mean, if we just do it internally without talking to customers, it's definitely a hypothesis. If we go and talk to 10 customers to kind of validate it, it's a little more validated. But until we actually design, you know, we're still not done. We still have to come up with, great, what feature ideas do we have to deliver on this value prop? Not only this, but these other ones. And then we need to do the UX design. And then that's when you show the mockups or prototype to customers, right? So part of it, I like what you're saying, is we're making a bet or a hypothesis at each stage. The question is, how can we test the hypothesis to know, you know, to know how we're doing and what we need to adjust or iterate, right? And for me, it's like, you want to do the discovery up front to make sure you're picking the right problems in the right target market segment. And then you want to get, do all this stuff we're talking about as quickly as possible. Get to the mockups, because the mockups in front of people or prototype, that's when the rubber really meets the road and you really get the learning of, oh, we thought this problem was important now, but they're saying not. And now, you know, that's really, you want to get to that mockup testing with customers or prototype testing with customers as quickly as you can, because that's when the learning truly starts.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Okay, we are running out of time, so I will throw my typical closing question. We covered a lot of ground already, but is there any learning about strategy you have along your journey that we haven't covered with these topics we discussed?
I mean, again, the main thing is that I my favorite definition of strategy is saying no. And you know, if you find, again, especially, and I have a talk on enterprise software where I make fun of sales and how they always say yes to every request, right? And that's not strategic. And I work with companies that – I work with enterprise companies that by the time I get there, they have what they call a custom software solution. Like, it's not a product. It's not a platform. They've built these one-off things for these different clients. And they're like, we want to transition from being a custom software shop to a product shop, right? So that's where you can end up if you say yes, right, to everything. And don't get me wrong, I understand as a startup, you got to make revenue. So, you know, I call it, you got to get the revenue, but you got to have a little bit of an overlay on product strategy. And what I'll say is, I know that as a PM, back to this empowerment, no may sound harsh and you may not feel like you can say no. So part of it is saying not now, not for this release. There are softer ways to do it. And part of to support that is a product roadmap. We didn't get into the roadmap, but basically, we're going to come up with a roadmap for our strategy.
Yeah.
And there'll be a temptation to put all the features in V1, right? But again, to your point, we're testing hypothesis. So we don't want to put all the features in V1. We want to put the critical features in V1, prototype it, test it, because I guarantee there's a pretty good chance something's going to change when we test that with people. So again, my main takeaway for strategy is it means saying no. It means placing bets, like you're saying, and then testing and validating it.
Love it. Love it. Okay, then this has been super wonderful. A lot of insights to digest and share. Where can people find you and what can they do to support your work?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Yeah, well, I think we covered a lot of ground in the time that we did, which is great. I know we went a little fast, but again, we've got the framework so people can go through that. Basically, yeah, I mean, my website is dan-olson.com, dan-olson.com. That's the main place where you can see my talks. You can see my speaking schedule. I'm excited that product conferences are back in person again. So I spoke at industry in the fall and I'm excited for 2024 to speak at some conferences. And then, my YouTube channel, actually, I didn't mention, youtube.com/Dan-Olson. We have almost 20,000 subscribers now. My talks are there, but also I run Lean Product Meetup. I've been running it for 10 years now. And so all the speakers that I have that speak at the meetup, we put their videos up there too. So it's one of the top product management channels. And then if you want to join, check out the meetup. Like I said, each month I bring in a top product speaker. It used to be in person only, but then with COVID we took it online and now we've kept it hybrid. So it's in person plus online. So it's a great way to see a top speaker. So that's at meetup.com/lean-product. But again, if you go to dan-olson.com, the links to all that are there. So yeah, awesome. Those are some ways people can see what's going on.
I have seen a ton of these videos, so I can guarantee they are great. So keep doing it. Keep up the great work. Dan, thanks so much for your time today.
Great. Thanks, Nacho. It was great talking with you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of 100 Product Strategies, the podcast by Product Direction. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram to get access to free weekly content that helps product people upgrade their skills and become more successful.
you can access more material, promotional trainings, and be notified of every episode of the show with Product Directions weekly newsletter. Join thousands of product leaders by registering in productdirection.co.